Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Another Appalachia. Coming up queer and Indian in a mountain place. By Nima Avashia. Narrated by Jeed Sadi. Directions to a Vanishing Place. Drive west on I-64, away from the airport named Yeager, carved into a mountaintop, away from the Capitol dome coated in gold, away from the cruelly nicknamed Needle City, with its shuttered buildings and staggering addiction numbers. Just 15.9 miles down the road, in between the exits for Institute and Nitro, right after the Pink Pony Strip Club, you hit exit 47, the exit for Cross Lanes, West Virginia. The exit for the place you call home. Cross Lanes, once the bedroom community for management at the chemical plants that sprung up along the Kanawha River during World War II. Now the plants have closed, and the community shrinks each year. Hang a right off the exit ramp. Pass a gas station, another gas station, a bank, a third gas station. A hair salon. Hit the drive-thru at Tudor's Biscuit World, home of the eighth wonder of the culinary world. A hash brown smothered with bottled cheese, sandwiched between two halves of biscuit. In high school, you would skip class in search of this delicacy, the only vegetarian item on the menu. At the one stoplight in town, continue onto Big Tyler Road. Past the National Institute of Technology building. Your dad used to say you'd end up there if you didn't get your grades up. The bank-turned-black megachurch Temple of Faith Ministries, where T.D. Jakes birthed his career as a televangelist. Lower Sun Valley Drive, where country music singer Kathy Mattea grew up. Upper Sun Valley Drive, where your best friend's family, with its six hardy children, used to shovel out the entire street during snowstorms rather than pay for a plow. Pass a pawn shop whose parking lot is always filled with cars. The bar whose name has changed at least 13 times since it opened. Your middle school alma mater, Andrew Jackson. Linger for just a minute here at the fields and courts of your youth. Every weekend from April to October, kids in stiff polyester uniforms perched on the pitcher's mound and bases. The sound of rubber basketball hitting pavement, then backboard, then swishing through the net was a steady presence on hot summer days. Now the infield is covered with weeds. The bases have been excavated. The grandstand is boarded up, even though it's peak season for Little League baseball. Beside the field, four poles reach skyward, giving the semblance and structure of a basketball court, but no backboards or nets exist. Tall grass emerges from the cracks in the concrete. Continue on your journey past Mousy's Car Wash, then make the familiar right turn into Westgate, whose big iron gates perpetually stand open. For sale signs litter the grass, each with a different real estate agent's name and phone number. The developer named every street in the neighborhood after his daughters, Karen, Dawn, Pamela, Anne. All of the houses share the same blueprint: 3 bedrooms, 2.5 bathrooms, finished basements. Even 20 years after moving out, you could stand blindfolded at the front door of any house in the neighborhood and walk through it without stumbling. Head straight down Dawn Street, take a left on Karen Circle, then finally a right onto Pamela Circle. Drive past the house that was yours throughout childhood, acquired by parents who were known as Rita and Doc to everyone in the neighborhood. A tiny maroon and white hand-painted sign, written in your mom's distinctive Gujarati-turned-English script, announces the house number, 5303. The garden has been replaced by grass, the basketball hoop torn down, your mom's unruly mint patch mowed over. No trace remains of the giant American flag your father taped on the door after 9/11. Of your parents' immense efforts to Americanize, only the rose bushes endure. Descend the gradual slope of Pamela Circle, where you learn to ride your bike. Your uncle's Bata sandals flapped as he ran alongside you. He held the seat to help you stay upright. Didn't let go till you told him you were ready. Skim over the patch of warm concrete where you lay in the summertime and stared at the multitude of stars shimmering on a navy blue blanket of sky. Past the Lunardini's house, where you taught baby Nick to say ball by tossing a basketball up and down in front of his bedroom window every morning on your way down the street to shoot hoops. Past Mr. Woody's garage, where he taxidermied animals whose beady glass eyes sometimes still haunt you in your sleep. Past the porches where you used to sit with Mr. Starcher and Mr. Casto in the evenings, your 11-year-old self nodding along sagely as they discussed the day's news. Occasionally, when talk of the plant came up, you'd interject with commentary pilfered from your dad's frustrated nighttime phone calls. Past the double hill between the Carneys and the Mondays houses, where you whiled away hours of childhood. Summers, you played King of the Mountain, wrestling with your friends for positioning at the top of the hill. Winters, you crashed your sled into the icy creek with glee, then hauled it back up the hill and rushed back down again. Past the streetlight that marked home base during games of spotlight every night of every summer between 6 and 16. Its daily illumination coincided with your mom yelling down the street that dinner was ready and you needed to come home. Past the two basketball hoops, diagonally placed, where you would play for hours. Barefoot in the summertime, in snow boots in the winter. Lee, Wes, and Andy were your steadfast playmates in these games. But early mornings with Mr. Withrow are what you remember most. The red-headed surrogate American dad who shot hoops with you, gave you driving lessons, grew figs and rhubarb for you. He died asleep in his armchair a few years ago, but you can still hear the triumphant cry he made every time he scored a bucket. The banks are open! Stop for just a moment at Mrs. Carney's house, one of the only neighbors from childhood still living on the street. Her golden hair is whiter, her body smaller, every time you visit. You sip her famous sun tea, and she updates you on the lives of the people who once populated this street. Those who have moved, those who have married, those who have died. Stare hard at the pink carpet, the antique walnut secretary desk, the grandfather clock, the paintings on the walls. The house feels empty without the sound of Mr. Carney's warm voice inviting you in for meandering chats that would sometimes start before the sun went down and not end until after the moon came up. Near the end of Pamela Circle, the last house on the street once belonged to a smiling family torn apart by divorce in the late 90s. Now the single-story house, red brick with white trim, has come off its foundation and edges toward a sinkhole. The windows are boarded up, and an eviction notice on the door declares the house uninhabitable. The ramshackle conditions of abandoned mining communities in the southern part of the state creep onto the very street where you once lived. Drive out of Westgate, past the roses, the basketball hoops, the streetlights, the plywood over windows, the grass coming through cracks in concrete, the headless basketball hoops, the endless rows of for sale signs. Head back down Big Tyler Road onto the ramp for I-64. away from the legions of loved ones who are slowly leaving too. Chemical bonds. In India, during his rural medicine rotation in the late 1960s, my father lived in a village terrorized by rabid dogs. They traveled in packs, chasing children, biting bicyclists, infecting the villagers with rabies. These villagers became paranoid, delirious, and hydrophobic, deteriorated into a comatose state, and then died in the span of just a few weeks. There was no money for vaccines, so my father purchased arsenic with his own meager savings, mixed it with milk, poured the poison into stainless steel bowls, and placed the bowls around the village, knowing the rabid dogs would hungrily lap up the milk. For days afterward, the bodies of dead dogs littered the streets, but the patients in the waiting room at my father's clinic no longer foamed at the mouth. In my father's moral calculus, the lives of humans are always worth more than the lives of animals, and what counts as poison for some is inoculation for the many. This is the worldview of a physician employed by a chemical plant for over 30 years. DDT kills mosquitoes, preventing the spread of debilitating diseases like malaria, dengue, and chikungunya. Asbestos stops the spread of fire in school buildings, hospitals, and homes. Methyl isocyanate kills insects, allowing crops to flourish. Chemicals prevent illness. Chemicals spur our nourishment. Chemicals save lives. Any accidents that happen are simply that, accidents. And no accident outweighs the benefits that chemicals confer. For my immigrant father, raised in poverty in the developing world, chemicals were a godsend, both in their concrete use and in the employment they provided him. This is the bedtime story that my father told me every night when I was a child. This is the story I believed well into adulthood, until, all at once, I didn't. After medical school, my father immigrated to the United States in 1969, first settling in Queens for his residency in occupational medicine, and then, 4 years later, taking a job at the Union Carbide plant in Institute, West Virginia. I cannot count the number of times in my life I have been asked the question, "Why West Virginia?" by disbelieving Americans who can't envision West Virginia as a state with any amount of diversity. But at the time, Indian immigrants did not have extensive options. They most often found work in the places where privileged Americans would not venture, in the midst of either urban or rural poverty. Put simply, my father needed a job. West Virginia was closer than Seadrift, Texas, his other option. And on their first visit, my parents found the lush greenery and mountains of the Mountain State so different from dry and dusty Gujarat, deeply alluring. They moved into a 3-bedroom, 2.5-bathroom house on a street called Pamela Circle, situated in a planned development called Westgate. Westgate was one of many such developments in the bedroom community of Cross Lanes, built specifically to house the managerial workers of the chemical industry. Add 2 kids, a fenced-in yard with a giant garden, a sky-blue Dodge Dart, and a growing bank account, and all the needed ingredients for the American dream suddenly fell into place for my family, thanks in no small part to Union Carbide. Doc, as most West Virginians quickly dubbed my dad, was deeply respected in the community. Quick-tempered, for sure, but also educated, generous, and neighborly. The kind of man who gave flu shots to the family and the neighbors, then drove around town administering them to the grocer, the tire shop guys, and the auto mechanic, and who conducted physical exams for all the kids on the street so the families wouldn't have to pay to see their primary care physician. The kind of man who would bring back prescription medicine from India because it was available cheaply and without prescription, and give it to the people in our community who needed it most. He sought at every turn to make himself useful, both because that was how he was raised, and because usefulness is the ultimate survival strategy for immigrants in America. Our neighbors responded in turn, always at the ready when the garden needed to be rototilled, the car needed an oil change, or my sister and I needed to learn a skill that my immigrant parents were not prepared to teach, like driving or shooting hoops or using power tools. My father's ethics were not typical, and certainly might have been frowned on by the medical establishment, but at the time, I understood them as the ethics of place. Being a good neighbor, and by extension, a good person, meant giving 100% of what you had to the community where you lived. The rules mattered less than the impact of your actions. This ethic of place followed me into my professional life as a teacher. I have taught at my school for nearly 2 decades and am as firmly rooted there as I was on Pamela's Circle. Many of my current students are the 3rd or 4th sibling in families that I've been teaching since 2003. Where my dad attended every wedding, anniversary celebration, and funeral of people who worked at the chemical plant, I attend the quinceañeras, graduation cookouts, and, tragically, funerals of former students on a regular basis. I am the writer of recommendation letters, the reference on job applications, the 0% interest moneylender, and the advisor on big decisions for hundreds of young people across the city of Boston. This does not feel optional for me. It feels like the way I am supposed to do my job, because this is how my father did his. In the early morning hours of December 3, 1984, my father received a panicked phone call from a high-powered executive at the corporate headquarters of the Union Carbide Corporation, the chemical plant where he was employed as the company doctor. 30 tons of toxic methyl isocyanate had leaked from the carbide compound in Bhopal, India, killing between 4,000 and 15,000 people. And severely burning and blinding thousands more, most of whom used the solid brick wall of the plant compound as a firm backing for their otherwise flimsy tin and plastic shanties. Carbide needed to send a crisis team to India. They wanted my Indian father to be part of their otherwise white team. I think of my father, aged 39, close to the same age I am now, with 2 young children, a mortgage, parents and siblings to financially support in India, and a keen sense of being the brown-skinned foreigner with the funny accent, trying desperately to assimilate into working-class Appalachian culture. What would he have lost if he had said no? What would he gain by saying yes? My father accepted his role as the token, went to Bhopal, acted as the face of Union Carbide in front of the global media and the Indian government. In the midst of thousands of his burned, blinded countrymen, in the midst of bodies strewn in the streets as dogs had once been in that village long ago, he sided with the company that signed his paycheck over the country of his birth. He embraced chemicals as the path to security and success for himself and for his family. He has held chemicals in that embrace ever since, never failing to come to their defense. For the first 12 years of my teaching career, my approach to the work only merited accolades. I taught a history methods course for student teachers to prepare them to work in the Boston public schools. I wrote the civics curriculum for the entire school district and ran professional development sessions training other teachers in how to use it. My classroom, with its clothesline of brightly colored T-shirts emblazoned with radical protest slogans, became a site for new teachers to observe as they honed their craft. In 2013, the school district recognized me as one of Boston's Educators of the Year. The following year, the district selected me, along with only two other teachers, to serve as members of the incoming superintendent's transition team, tasked with crafting a new vision for the work of the Boston Public Schools. I felt my voice and my influence growing. Friends in other schools often described feeling like they were widgets, unseen and unknown by a district that viewed them as numbers rather than humans. I understood their experience, but couldn't relate. I wasn't a widget, or so I thought. Then, in 2016, the school district released budget proposals for individual schools, and we learned that my school faced over $1 million in budget cuts. We stood to lose half of our arts department, much-needed special education teachers, and some of our strongest teachers of academic content. Our staff rallied, went to budget hearings, and gave passionate testimony explaining the impact of such deep cuts on our school. Still, the budget proposal remained unchanged. Frightened by the depth of the cuts, and certain that they foretold the approaching death of our school community, I reached out to a local newspaper and asked them to write a story. The Bay State Banner printed a piece about the impact of budget cuts with a giant picture of my face running on the front page. The day after the piece dropped, my awkward rookie principal called me into his office after school. He'd been contacted by his bosses, who had asked him to deliver a message. "All communication with media needs to be cleared through BPS Communications." What happened next is unclear. Did he fumble his words? Did I mishear him? I could swear that he said, "Otherwise, you risk losing your job." He claims he said, "Otherwise, I could risk losing my job." I stared at him, flabbergasted. "I can't lose my job for speaking to the press," I said, the civics teacher in me growing more outraged by the moment. "Freedom of speech is protected for public school employees. There was a whole Supreme Court case about it in 1968. He shrugged helplessly. "I'm just passing on the message I was given." I left his office and called our union organizer. "I just got told to stop speaking to media without permission from BPS or I will lose my job," I told her. The next morning, the union president wrote a blurb in our e-newsletter describing the incident, stridently clarifying the free speech rights of public school teachers. By midday, the Boston Globe had posted a story with the headline, "Union Accuses Boston School Department of Trying to Silence Teachers." That afternoon, the superintendent of the Boston Public Schools called me on my commute home asking, "Couldn't you have resolved this internally? Why did you feel the need to take it public?" The impact mattered more than the rules. This is what I had grown up believing. Now I was being told that following the rules of silence and subordination mattered more than protecting the health of my community. "I did try to resolve it internally," I told him. "We went to you. We went to the school committee. We begged you to listen, and you didn't change anything. So then we took it public." After this, I was no longer the favored teacher of the establishment. I transformed into someone new, someone different, someone feared for my ability to create shame within district leadership. And fear made people listen in a different way. When I emailed the superintendent with a concern, he responded immediately. I got pulled into meetings with higher-ups on a regular basis regarding issues ranging from youth violence to school police cooperation with immigration and customs enforcement. The district's strategy for reining me in was to pull me closer rather than push me away. The school district did not ultimately restore our funds, but the experience taught me something my father had been unable to, that sometimes acting ethically on behalf of my community required fighting against, rather than alongside, my employer. My dad and I do not talk about our family's tangled history with chemicals. In truth, we don't talk much at all about topics that fall outside the bounds of the following three themes: financial investments, dead and dying West Virginian loved ones, and the weather in Texas, where he now lives. This dynamic is not new. When I was a kid, my dad assigned me Wall Street Journal articles to read and then required me to share summaries and reactions with him before dinner. His bedtime stories always included a hygiene moral, usually about the importance of brushing one's teeth. His great-grandfather left the family to study law and never returned. His father, my grandfather, did not express emotion even when we visited him after 5 years of absence. Without models of what deep father-child bonds could look like, my dad did the best he could. Still, our conversations run more educational and transactional than they do emotional. Every time I have written about him, I've been asked in workshop to include scenes between us. But I don't see my father in scene. I see him in monologue. My dad speaking, me listening, and then him abruptly hanging up the phone or leaving the room when he tires of talking. Some of this is generational, some of it is gendered, some of it is cultural. But the notion of my father talking with me about his history or his beliefs is simply something I haven't experienced. He has talked at me, and I can summarize those ideas deftly, but the scene eludes me. Scene implies an exchange of ideas, and there is no exchange between my father and me. He has his ideas, I have mine. Never the twain shall meet. Searching for ways to bring my father's voice into this piece, I turn to the archives of the Charleston Gazette, the main newspaper for our community in West Virginia. I found a piece written by my father in 2015. 12 years after leaving the Valley, he, too, still mulls on this history. The piece, entitled Remembering a Better West Virginia, was published on the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II, and is an amalgam of all the snippets my father has repeated to me time and time again. During the war, chemical companies were asked by our elected government to make goods needed for the war effort. At the end of the war, they could have laid off everybody, but instead, they repurposed these chemical facilities to make ingredients that make latex paint, crayons, detergents, soaps, and shampoos. They made rubber additives that made tires and rubber belts last longer and made driving safer. They made swimming pools cleaner and chemicals that farmers and the home gardeners could safely use to produce the crops that fed the world. A couple of dozen cases of mesothelioma from asbestos occurred. But balance that against hundreds of people who did not get burns from hot processes and leaks that did not occur from asbestos gaskets. In those days, safer substitutes were not yet invented. Books have been written on workplace tragedies, but I could easily write a book on how a Clay County kid came to Charleston, got a job to collect samples from production units on bicycle, and quickly delivered them to a lab for analysis. This kid soon realized the path to upward mobility was education. He took classes at Morris Harvey College to get his degree to become a chemist, finally becoming the manager for environmental affairs. He retired and became an industry consultant for several more years. And this story was repeated by many. Today, Kanawha Valley's chemical
sample complete. Ready to continue?